ट्राई टू डिड, ही ट्राई टू आइसोलेट रशिया बाय टेकिंग इंडिया इनटू कॉन्फिडेंस, बट हियर इज अ थिंग दैट इंडिया वोंट डू एनीथिंग लाइक दैट, एंड देर इज नो पॉइंट ऑफ डूइंग दिस काइंड ऑफ थिंग, स्पेशली फॉर द यूरोपियन यूनियन. इंडिया इज एन इंडिपेंडेंट सोवरेन कंट्री, वी हैव आर ओन डिसीजन मेकिंग प्रोसेस, वी हैव आर ओन फॉरेन पॉलिसी, वी हैव आर नेशनल इंटरेस्ट, एंड वी आर प्राइम मिनिस्टर वॉन्टेड टू सेफ गार्ड आर नेशनल इंटरेस्ट रादर देन गेटिंग इन्फ्लुएंस बाय समबडी एल्स फॉर समबडी एल्स इज इंटरेस्ट. देर इज नो पॉइंट डूइंग इट. दो जर्मन चांसलर ट्राइड टू परसुएड हिम टू एट लीस्ट ओपनली क्रिटिसाइज द रशियन स्टांस ऑफ अटैकिंग और वेजिंग अ वॉर ओवर द यूक्रेन. But here, the Prime Minister decided not to say a word in media or make any kind of promises to European Union or to the German chancellors about having any enmity with any person. That is why he even abstained from voting in the United Nations.
Dr. Najmi, you've mentioned that India abstained from voting in the UN General Assembly resolution against Russia. So what does this suggest about New Delhi's foreign policy?
First and foremost, it suggests that New Delhi's foreign policy or India's foreign policy is independent now. We are not following dictates from any of the superpower or so-called the colonial powers of Europe. We are free to take our decisions. Nobody is going to influence us or our foreign policy. At the time of independence, our first prime minister, he suggested the idea of non-alignment and safeguarding the national interest of India first. And I feel that Modi, the current Prime Minister, he is following the same policies at the moment. It is in national interest that he is not criticizing the Russian or Ukrainian war, or he is not openly criticizing Russia for waging war on Ukraine. That is for our national interest. There were almost 141 countries which actually voted against Russia, and there were 32 countries, including India, Iran, and South Africa and China, who abstained from voting. And that is what our national interest told us or guided us to do, and which actually is a better policy. During 60s, 70s, it was again Russia who has been supporting India as a country, as compared to the USA or the Western alliances who have been supporting Pakistan at that time.
Dr. Najmi, India is fulfilling majority of its oil demand from Russia and has also been opposing Western sanctions on Moscow. So will it help in bringing the two countries closer, reducing the influence of the U.S. in the region?
Yes, I feel that the American influence is on decline at the moment. Earlier, United States of America, they created Quad. Quad included India, America, Japan and Australia, four different economies, India being a developing economy, Japan flourishing economy, Australia again flourishing economy, and the USA. They included India only to make Asia more stabilizing or to challenge China, another superpower in the making. So they tried to isolate Russia by doing that, and America wanted to extend its influence beyond the border. They wanted to have their influence over Asian countries also, and for which they found India as the best kind of partner at that time. But with the times changing, with the ongoing Russian and Ukrainian war, the Russia is actually selling oil at the minimal cost to India, and India is gaining a lot of profit by buying that kind of oil. So there is no point that India will be having any enmity or bad relations or sour relationship with Russia.
Last but not least, Dr. Najmi, now Germany wishes for a free trade deal between India and the EU. How is this agreement going to impact China's influence in the region?
Well, India is one of the largest growing economy at the moment, and according to World Bank data, the GDP growth of India is 8% at the moment, and it is one of the most thriving economy where different European powers or even US, they want to invest in these ventures. Besides, it is having a very good youth which is educated and which is employable. So they find a lot of venues of success when they come to India. But saying that you cannot deny the existence and power that China is having at the moment in the industry, in the finances, or in the business, or in the trade worldwide. China's FDI, foreign direct investment, is much higher as compared to India. Their production powers is much higher as compared to India. They do not follow any labor laws. They do not follow any guidelines from United Nations or from the Human Rights Commission. They do whatever they feel like doing.
There you have it, Associate Professor in Political Science, Dr. Mehnaz Najmi from New Delhi. Thank you for being on the program, Miss. Now, let's see what people have to say on social media.
Insightful Geopolitics tweeted, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz on visit to India. We want to deepen Germany's relationship with India. Some 1,500 and more companies operate in India. Germany is trying to push for a $5.2 billion deal to sell India's 6 conventional submarines. Moh Mustafa Hossein said, German Chancellor Scholz has tried to convince India's Prime Minister Modi to side with the West against Russia during a visit to the South Asian state, peddling the blame Russia for the food insecurity narrative. Prime Minister Modi, for his part, claimed that India is neutral. Divya Kochar tweeted, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz calls on the world for very clear stance on Ukraine while on a state visit to India, and also urged Indian techies to work in Germany. Nameless Cynic says, thought for the day, if the U.S. will not tolerate a strong Russia or China or even a strong Germany and EU, surely India has noted that, which explains why the Indians prefer to keep relations open with Russia for their defense needs and not the U.S.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Being one of the world's fastest-growing economies, the expansion of trade relations and access to new markets is a necessity for India. Yvonne and India share a common outlook towards the development of the Chabahar port, which is expected to lead to regional convergence and growth. Being easily accessible from India's western coast, this port can help India access new markets. The development of Chabahar port will also help strengthen relations between Tehran and New Delhi.
Iran offers extensive and diverse economic attractions for India, the most important being the rich oil and energy resources, transit corridors, and the Chabahar port. The importance of the Chabahar port has increased following the unfair Western sanctions against Tehran. This has attracted the attention of countries like Russia and India for its expansion. New Delhi is seeking to cooperate with Russia, Central Asian and Caucasus countries through the framework of the International North-South Multimodal Corridor. During the 2016 visit of the Indian Prime Minister to Iran, a trilateral agreement was signed by India, Iran and Afghanistan to establish an international transit and transportation corridor. Following the agreement, India, in cooperation with the Iranian government, participated in the development of the first phase of Shahid Beheshti Terminal at Chabahar. However, there has been a significant delay from the Indian side in the development of the port. According to the deputy head of Iran Ports and Maritime Organization, now after 7 years of the agreement between Iran and India for the expansion of Chabahar port, only 25% of the work has been done. This delay from the Indian side has led to uncertainty in Tehran, making many political and economic experts suggest a multifaceted policy for Iran based on the formation of a consortium to attract foreign investment to the country.
Chabahar port is a cost-effective, reliable, fast, safe and profitable route for trade exchanges. Located in 2 international transit corridors, due to its strategic location, the port has the potential of being the connecting hub of the region. Chabahar is vital for India to reduce its dependence on the Suez Canal for transporting cargo to Europe. The ports will also help New Delhi realize the envisioned international north-south transport corridor between India, Iran and Russia, establishing connectivity between Europe, Central Asia and India.
In addition to being a cost-effective, fast and a safe port, Chabahar is located in two international transit corridors, north-south and east-west, providing a sea and land route to Central Asia and Afghanistan via Iran's eastern and northeastern borders. The advantage of the north-south corridor for India is to shorten access to Europe and other countries. This route is about 7,200 kilometers and almost 60% less than the sea route through the Suez Canal, reducing the time of cargo transportation from more than 40 days to just 20 days. Chabahar Port has the potential not only to become India's gateway to Europe, Russia, and other Central Asian countries, but also to change into one of the most important ports of the world. India has expressed its vision to transform Shahid Beheshti Port in Chabahar into a transit hub and connect it to Central Asia. The interests of the two countries in the development of this port can help in securing the economic and geopolitical goals of New Delhi and Tehran. The development of this port and the integration of Iran into the Shanghai and Eurasia Organization in the future will lead to stronger relations between Iran, India, Russia, and China.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by political analyst Mr. Dilip Cherian from New Delhi. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now, what do you think are the main factors driving the trade growth between Iran and India, and how do you see this trend evolving in the coming years?
India's growth of trade with a whole bunch of countries has been on the upswing. India is a big buyer of energy, petroleum, and other forms of energy, gas. And the reason why we are doing that is because we need energy resources for the kind of growth that we are fueling. That's one part of trade. The other part of trade is, of course, Indian companies trying to export and Indian companies needing inputs for a bunch of things that are now being produced here. So in terms of trade, India is a growing trading player and Iran is a source of many of the items that India needs. India also finds Iran a potential market into which to export. And we have had traditionally very good links. So this is why you see the growth. And this growth is only going to continue, irrespective and despite whatever sanctions, global shifts that happen. India has, in its trading mentality, a space for Iran and countries like that.
Now, Mr. Cherian, the Chabahar port has been identified as a key area of cooperation between Iran and India. So how important do you think this port is to both countries and what potential benefits could it bring to the region as a whole?
Wherever there is a trade link between India and any other country, we have seen that where a direct port facility is available, growth is faster. As far as the new port is concerned, the fact is that this port has a special significance for India because it is something we have cooperated on. And I think that in many senses, there is a deeper link than the symbolic one as far as this port is concerned. Because India recognizes the strategic need to have what we call friendly ports in the neighborhood. This is initially going to be proven through a track record of higher trading volumes. And what happens then is that as far as shipping lines and shipping lanes are concerned, this becomes a route of traffic. And in addition, and this is the big strategic aspect of it. In addition, it ensures that as far as our sea lanes are concerned, they have importance not just for us, but for all our trading partners. Because besides the product that comes directly from Iran, there will be product which actually gets transshipped via Iran. And I think that, therefore, more countries get a, shall I say, a vested interest in ensuring that these trade routes are kept awake, alive, and growing, irrespective of what other geopolitical factors may pressurize countries into changing direction, into moving, you know, moving the most favored route, etc. My personal belief and my analysis as an economist has always been that trade always precedes flag. And therefore, in this case too, the fact that trade is growing allows the flags in both the ports, or in that port and other ports in India, to be freely exchanged in terms of as the commerce and the growth of commerce is concerned.
Now, Mr. Cherion, let's talk about the competition as well. China's development of the Gwadar port in Pakistan is seen as a potential rival to India's interests in the region. So how do you see the competition between India and China playing out in the context of the Chabahar port and broader economic cooperation between Iran and India?
The Chabahar port is significant beyond the China factor. For India, the China factor has grown in importance a lot over the last 5 years. China was never seen as the kind of, shall we say, active aggressor that it is being seen in India today. Having said that, though, we also have to recognize that the quantum of commercial trade between India and China has quadrupled even during the period of extreme tension. Now, as far as the port in Pakistan is concerned, while it may be seen as a kind of commercial threat to the Chabahar, to the Chabahar importance in this region, for India, we are very clear that no Pakistani port and no port which is controlled and run on investments from China can be a port where we will have the same level of comfort. So I think that in terms of packing, as it were, Chabahar will continue to receive more and more attention from India, even as the Chinese aid gets underway. So in some senses, we already have a time advantage. And that time advantage is going to only solidify the kind of, shall I say, invested effort in keeping these trade routes as those important for us. In any case, the quantum of trade we do with Pakistan is not very high. And therefore, the port there will at best be of transshipment importance and not of direct trade importance.
Now, last but not least, Mr. Cherion, some experts have suggested that India's slow progress in developing the Chabahar port has created uncertainty, leading Iran to consider forming a consortium with other countries. So what do you think can be the reason for this delay on India's part, and how do you think the situation could be resolved?
Since I haven't studied this and what the current state of investments, progress, what the delays are, this is not an area that I'm going to comment on. All I can say is that India's commitment may seem that it's not moving at the pace it should. But that having been said, those are endogenous factors. And I think the basic philosophy and strategy remains consistent with what we've promised. And I'm sure that this will only be, I would call, a blip in the horizon, and we shouldn't worry too much about it.
There you have it, political analyst Mr. Dilip Cherion from New Delhi. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see what people have to say on social media.
Groucho Marx tweeted,
Congrats, India, on setting up a trade route between Iran, Russia, China, and your brilliant move. May it multiply in all aspects to all your interests, your partners, and may it increase. And add more member states just to irritate the Uncle Sams of that Orionish planet in Ozone Zombie. Lakshman Sagar said, India and Iran are in talks over long-term usage contract of the Chabahar port. The port gives India sea and land access to Afghanistan and Central Asia, bypassing Pakistan, and also acts as a gateway to the east and west of the Caspian Sea as part of the international north-south transit corridor. Economic Times tweeted, Indian Minister of Ports, Shipping and Waterways, Sarbanand Sonowal, has recently stated that India and Iran are in talks regarding the terms of the primary contract for the extended usage of Chabahar port. Ashok Swain says, under Manmohan Singh, India had planned Chabahar port in Iran to counter China-control Gwadar port in Pakistan. In 2018, Iran invited China and Pakistan to join Chabahar port project, and now Iran is going to supply electricity to Gwadar port.
And that was our episode about the recent visit of the German Chancellor to India and also Iran-India relations and the significance of Chabahar port. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A non-governmental group in the United States that closely monitors the violence of the police in the United States has reported that last year the U.S. police had a record of killing people, especially black people, as they killed an average of more than three per day. Every year in the United States, about 1,000 citizens are victims of police brutality and die from police shootings. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Officials said on Monday, 30th of January, two more Memphis police officers have been disciplined and three emergency responders fired in connection with the death of Tyre Nichols. That brings the total number of officers who have been disciplined to seven, including the five police officers who were fired and charged recently with second-degree murder and other offences in Nichols's beating and January 10 deaths. According to multiple reports, the Memphis police major, Karen Rudolph, said on Monday, 30th of January, police officer Preston Hemphill was relieved of his duty and put on what is known as administrative leave. Later on that day, it said another police officer has also been relieved of his duties, but without naming the person or specifying what role they played in the incident. Memphis Police Major Karen Rudolph stopped short of saying what role Hemphill had at the scene of Nichols' deadly beating or whether he would be charged with a crime in connection with the killing, as several other police officers have been. But Karen Rudolph said that the investigation into Nichols' death continues and more information will be shared as it is developed. In a statement, police said all seven police officers have been relieved of their duties on 8th of January. Also on Monday, fire department officials announced the firing of the emergency medical technicians Robert Long and Michael Sandridge and Lieutenant Michelle Whitaker in connection with Tyre Nichols' death. The Memphis Fire Chief, Gina Sweet, said in a statement that her department had received a call from police to respond to a report of a person who had been pepper sprayed, and the workers arrived as Ty Nichols was handcuffed and leaning up against a squadron car. The statement said Long and Sandridge, based on the nature of the call and information police gave them, failed to conduct an adequate patient assessment of Ty Nichols. Michelle Whitaker and the driver remained in the vehicle. The statement said an investigation determined that all three had violated multiple policies and protocols. Officer Hemphill was the third police officer at the traffic stop that preceded the violent arrest, but was not at the scene where Ty Nichols was beaten. Lawyers for the Nichols family asked on Monday why the department had not disclosed disciplinary action against Officer Hemphill earlier and why he had not been fired or charged. News of the additional police officer's removal comes as calls for changes to American policing intensify after Ty Nichols' death. The chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, Stephen Horsford, said a group of 60 members of Congress had asked to meet with the president in the coming days to push for negotiations on much-needed national reforms to our justice system, specifically the actions and conduct of our law enforcement. The appeal to President Biden, who has called on Congress to pass police reforms, came as protests prompted by Nichols' killing continued in Memphis, Tennessee over the weekend. Ty Nichols, who was black, died on 10th of January, just 3 days after Memphis police officers beat him after a traffic stop. Ty Nichols' parents, who have been invited to attend President Biden's State of the Union speech on 7th of February, said the 29-year-old was driving home after photographing the sunset. Video footage released by Memphis officials last week showed police officers kicking and punching Ty Nichols and hitting him with a baton. CNN's website has also covered this story and tells us more. The attorney representing the Nichols family, the family of Ty Nichols, a 29-year-old black man killed by Memphis police recently, has called on Congress to use this tragic death to pass reform legislation to rein in the epidemic of police brutality in America. Ben Crump, the attorney representing the Nichols family, said, "Shame on us if we don't use this tragic death to finally get the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act passed." Ty Nichols' death had sparked protests across the United States and rekindled the debate about the need to change the culture of police violence in the country. Ben Crump said, "It is this culture that says it doesn't matter whether the police officers are black or Hispanic or white, that is somehow allowed for you to trample on the constitutional rights of certain citizens from certain ethnicities and from certain communities." Members of Congress said on Sunday, 29th of January, they need to revive their effort to pass substantial police reforms. The chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Dick Durbin, a Democrat of Illinois, acknowledged that while police officers purportedly risk their lives for Americans every day, some of the same officers are engaging in horrible conduct. He told ABC's This Week program, "What we saw on the streets of Memphis, Tennessee was just inhumane, horrible. I don't know what created this rage in these police officers that they would congratulate themselves for beating a man to death, but that is literally what happened." Dick Durbin said he would not rule out a federal investigation into the Memphis Police Department following the violent encounter with Ty Nichols. According to academics and advocates for police reform who track such deaths, nationwide police have killed roughly 3 people per day, consistently since 2020. Police reform talks, spurred by the death of George Floyd at the hands of a white police officer in Minneapolis, Minnesota, collapsed in Congress in 2021, after lawmakers failed to strike a bipartisan deal. CBS News has also covered this story and tells us more. More protests have erupted across the United States, including in the city of Memphis, Tennessee, against the killing of the young black man by the Memphis police, with protesters marching and blaming the U.S. government for the rising violence against the black community and saying the system is murdering us. Thousands of people have marched through the streets of Oakland, California, to protest police brutality and systemic racism against minorities, and to demand justice for young black man Ty Nichols. The protest rally was organized by the Anti-Police Terror Project. Speakers at the rally included family members of residents who were killed by police. They strongly condemned the violence against people of color in America. Kat Brooks, executive director of the Anti-Police Terror Project, which organized the event in Oakland, California, said, "What happened to Ty Nichols is not an exception, it's the rule, and it happens every single day in this country. This is what American policing looks like." People from around San Francisco Bay Area joined in the protest to express their outrage at the U.S. police killing of blacks and other minorities. Brianna Vieira, who lives in San Jose, California, was quoted as saying, "Obviously, we're here to collectively grieve Ty Nichols' brutal murder and to stand in solidarity with the Memphis community." Police violence against African Americans and Asian Americans in the United States has assumed alarming proportions in recent years, creating fear and panic. In May of 2020, following the Minneapolis police killing of George Floyd, mass protests erupted in the United States against police brutality and systemic racism. Protests and demonstrations took place in many U.S. cities and spread to even beyond America's borders. The 46-year-old, George Floyd, was killed by a white police officer who was kneeling on his neck. Video recording of the killing showed the former killer cop, Derek Chauvin, pressing on George Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes as the victim begged for mercy. The video clip went viral, triggering mass protests throughout the United States and the wider world.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Trilateral meetings in progress in the capital, Beijing. The participants: Saudi Arabia's National Security Advisor, Mossad bin Mohammed al-Aban; Iran's Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani; and Wang Yi, Director, Office of Foreign Affairs Commission, the Communist Party of China Central Committee. Then came the announcement. After 7 years, Iran and Saudi Arabia have resumed diplomatic ties. Meanwhile, Ali Shamkhani expressed willingness to continue constructive dialogue, fully implement their consensus, and enhance good neighborliness to jointly safeguard regional security.
At the end of the talks, we reached a decision to start a new chapter after 7 years of severed relations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia. While considering the interests of the two countries, the security and well-being of the region, and preventing undue intervention from extra-regional forces, particularly from the West, and constant mischief by the Zionist regime in the region. We hope that this new chapter will compensate for the stagnation of relations over these last 7 years and also lead to stability and security in the region, as well as the improvement of the welfare of all its people.
Saudi Arabia was also positive in its assessment of what this deal means. When it comes to the agreement itself, this is what we know.
Both have agreed to restore diplomatic relations. This will be followed up by the reopening of embassies and missions within a period not exceeding 2 months. Per protocol, this means the exchange of ambassadors. The two countries agreed to implement the Agreement on Security Cooperation signed on April 17, 2001, and the General Agreement reached on May 27, 1998, aimed at fostering ties in economic, commercial investment, technical, and scientific fields, to name a few. Since the announcement of the restoration of ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia, there's been a tidal wave of responses and reactions. The U.S. President Joe Biden's response was clearly off the mark. He said better relations between Israel and their Arab neighbors are better for everybody. As for Israel, the opposition has been quick to react and has slammed Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It said the restoration of diplomatic ties between Saudi Arabia and Iran represents a failure of foreign policy by Israel's longest-serving Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. There's no doubt, however, that this is seen as a major defeat for the U.S. and its standing, especially when it comes to diplomacy. Mark Dubowitz, the chief executive of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, has said, "Lose, lose, lose for American interests." This agreement demonstrates the Saudis don't trust Washington to have their back. Iran sees opportunity to peel away U.S. allies to end international isolation. Although this may be a huge diplomatic victory for China, this is also a victory of Iranian policy when it came to Yemen and Saudi Arabia itself. Let's not forget, this was a face-saving deal for the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, since his Yemen policy was defeated due to the Ansarullah movement's dominance in Yemen. Saudi Arabia was also defeated in Syria when it backed Daesh terrorists with the help of his allies, like the U.S. Other issues leading to the severance of diplomatic ties included how Saudi Arabia executed prominent Shiite cleric Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr. Saudi Arabia was also responsible when it led Persian Gulf Arab monarchies to blacklist the Lebanese resistance group Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. Saudi's past behavior shows that it cannot be a trustworthy partner until certain actions are taken when it comes to issues like Yemen, Palestine, and Syria, where it has played destructive roles. It remains to be seen whether this agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran to ensure the security of West Asia would translate into a decrease of the U.S. presence in the region to its eventual withdrawal completely.
France has been hit by yet another wave of mass strikes and protests. The row is about President Emmanuel Macron's controversial pension reforms. An estimated 1.28 million people have participated in the nationwide strike. The demonstrations were some of the biggest in decades. The nationwide strike have disrupted train services, shut schools, and halted fuel deliveries. Unions have stepped up their campaign to force a U-turn on a deeply unpopular policy. Workers from different sectors have walked out of their jobs and held demonstrations in Paris and other cities. Refineries have stopped fuel deliveries, most trains have come to a halt, and power production has decreased during the industrial action. Some scuffles have broken out on the sidelines, with some people throwing projectiles at police who responded with tear gas. Unions have threatened to freeze up the economy with work stoppages. Some unions have called for open-ended strikes in sectors from refineries and oil depots to electricity and gas facilities. This is the sixth time since the start of the year that unions called a nationwide day of strikes and demonstrations. The disruption is expected to be greater and last longer as rail unions call for rolling, open-ended strikes. This could affect all national trains as well as international routes. Trains to Germany and Spain came to a halt, and those to and from the United Kingdom and Belgium were reduced by a third. Some students have also blockaded faculties, and some schools closed as teachers staged a one-day strike.
I don't want to work until I'm 64. I say to myself, enough already. For the moment, there are only promises made, and we don't know when it's going to end. So it's better to fight now than to lose our gains. That's it.
People are fed up. People are exhausted. People see around them that there are plenty of colleagues who don't even make it to the current legal retirement age. So how can we expect them to make it to 64? And then, for us, it's 64. But for the years to come and our children, what age will it be? 66? I think the government hasn't taken everything into account.
The strikes and industrial actions are about President Emmanuel Macron's unpopular pension reforms. His government is planning to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64 and increase the number of years of work required to claim a full pension. The change will be gradual, increasing by 3 months per year from September until 2030. From 2027, workers will have to make social security contributions over 43 years rather than 42 in order to get full pensions. The government says the reforms would boost the employment rate among 60 to 64-year-olds. In France, the employment rate in this age category is just 33% compared with 61% in Germany and 69% in Sweden.
Precisely, it is the most precarious people who are going to suffer the most from the reform and who are going to serve two more years. It is scandalous. Mrs. Born has never been a cleaning lady. She has never been a social worker for handicapped kids. She has never done work where you have to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to go to work with cut-off hours, to work on Saturday nights, on Sundays. She does not know at all. She doesn't know what the people and the population go through. So yes, it is scandalous.
Macron has vowed to go ahead with the bill. The reforms were at the heart of the President Emmanuel Macron's re-election campaign last year, but are proving deeply unpopular. His cabinet says the changes are essential to prevent the pension system from falling into deficit and younger people carrying the burden. Macron's centralist alliance has the most seats in the National Assembly but lost its majority in legislative elections last year. Therefore, it needs to count on the support from the right to be able to pass the bill. Another option for the government would be to use a special constitutional power to force the bill through without a vote. This is a risky choice because such a decision would be highly unpopular.
Since the war in Syria began in early 2011, Western nations and their regional allies have left no stones unturned to topple the Syrian government. These efforts were led by the U.S., which coordinated the efforts of the Western and Arab nations against Damascus. But the U.S. soon began to dispatch its own soldiers and military hardware to the war-stricken nation. The U.S. claimed that the troops sent to Syria were tasked with fighting Daesh terrorists and helped the so-called moderate armed opponents of President Bashar al-Assad. Daesh terrorists were defeated mainly due to the efforts of the resistance front, and U.S.-backed efforts to topple the government in Damascus largely failed. But the U.S. still continues to keep hundreds of its troops in northeast Syria. Over the years, U.S. forces have been involved in the theft of Syria's natural resources, including its oil.
Very importantly, as you know, we have the oil, and we left soldiers for the oil because we took the oil and we're working on that, and we have it very nicely secured.
We've kept the oil. We stayed back and kept the oil. Other people can patrol the border of Syria, frankly, and Turkey, let them, they've been fighting for 1,000 years. Let them do the border. We don't want to do that. We want to bring our soldiers home. But we did leave soldiers because we're keeping the oil. I like oil. We're keeping the oil.
The U.S. regime is also using its troops in that region to coordinate anti-Damascus efforts with the Kurdish militants. By backing the Kurdish-led SDF in eastern Syria, the U.S. controls about a third of the country, an area where most of Syria's oil fields are located. Just recently, the U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, Mark Milley, visited Syria, marking his first visit to the country as a top U.S. general. Damascus condemned the visit as, quote, illegal and a flagrant violation of Syria's sovereignty. Calls are now growing to end the illegal presence in Syria. A resolution was circulated in the U.S. House of Representatives, which called for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria. The resolution was submitted by Republican Matt Gaetz and was supported by other Republican lawmakers. The resolution was ultimately defeated by Congress, but it could be a signal of growing uneasiness with the presence of U.S. troops in the war-torn nation.
I do not believe that what stands between a caliphate and not a caliphate are the 900 Americans who have been sent to this hellscape with no definition of victory, with no clear objective, and purely existing as a vestige to the regime change, failed foreign policies of multiple former presidents.
Syria is not the only country in West Asia that hosts unwanted U.S. troops. Syria's neighbor Iraq is also home to hundreds of U.S. soldiers. Earlier this week, the Pentagon chief made an unannounced visit to Iraq, where he announced Washington's intent to maintain its military presence there. Austin is the most senior official in the Biden administration to visit the country. The presence of U.S. troops in Iraq began in 2003, after Washington invaded the country. March 19, 2003, the U.S. and Britain invaded Iraq in blatant violation of international law under the pretext of finding weapons of mass destruction. But no such weapons were ever discovered in Iraq.
The objective is to compel Iraq to destroy its illegal weapons of mass destruction and its programs to develop and produce missiles and more of those weapons. Saddam is dangerous. The world would be a better place without him. But the reason he poses a growing danger to the United States and its allies is that he possesses chemical and biological weapons and is seeking nuclear weapons. And unlike my colleague from West Virginia and Maryland, I do not believe this is a rush to war. I believe it's a march to peace and security.
Indeed, the facts and Iraq's behavior show that Saddam Hussein and his regime are concealing their efforts to produce more weapons of mass destruction.
At this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
According to the California-based investigative organization Project Censored, more than 1 million Iraqis were killed as a result of the U.S.-led invasion and occupation of the country. The U.S. withdrew its forces in 2011, claiming that it had ended its combat mission in Iraq. But hundreds of U.S. troops still remain inside the Arab country on what Washington describes as an advisory mission. Following the U.S. assassination of Iran's anti-terror commander, General Qasem Soleimani, and his Iraqi trench mate, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, Iraqi parliament passed a resolution that called for the withdrawal of all U.S. troops from the country. However, Washington kept its force inside the country in defiance of a resolution. The U.S. military declared the end of its combat mission in Iraq in December 2021, but it still maintains a number of troops there under the guise of playing an advisory and training role.
Chinese President Xi Jinping has strongly censured the U.S. in a speech at an annual summit of the ruling Communist Party. He said Washington is leading a campaign to suppress and contain China's development. Xi, who will begin his third consecutive term as the country's president, said Beijing faces unprecedented challenges from the West.
Western countries led by the United States have implemented all-round containment, encirclement, and suppression of China, which has brought unprecedented severe challenges to our country's development.
The Chinese president said during the past 5 years, the West has imposed a new set of hurdles that threaten to weigh down China's economic growth. The U.S. and its allies have imposed curbs on tech exports to China, prompting Beijing to double down on the need to shift away from imports for sectors perceived as vital to national security, including semiconductors and artificial intelligence. The U.S. is also working to expand its restrictions on the export of chipmaking equipment to China. Xi said China must have the courage to fight as the country faces profound and complex changes in both the domestic and international landscape. He urged private firms to take the initiative to pursue high-quality development.
I've always said there are two critical areas for China. One is to safeguard our rice bowl, and the other is to build up a strong manufacturing sector. As a great nation of 1.4 billion people, we must rely on ourselves. We can't depend on international markets to save us.
Earlier this week, Xi vowed to bolster China's manufacturing capacity and said the country should be able to fend for itself. Later, China's new foreign minister reiterated the president's forceful language on U.S. containment. He warned that conflict and confrontation with the U.S. is inevitable if Washington continues its reckless approach.
The United States claims to be competing to win against China rather than seeking a conflict. But in fact, the U.S. so-called competition is total containment and suppression, a zero-sum game in which you die and I live. If the U.S. does not hit the brakes but continues to speed down the wrong path, no amount of guardrails can prevent derailing. There will surely be conflict and confrontation.
The foreign minister also noted that the development of other countries would not undermine that of the U.S. Overall, the U.S. administration of Joe Biden has shown little interest in cooling tensions with China and frames its engagement with Chinese officials as managing of competition rather than an effort to resolve issues. In Washington, John Kirby, the White House national security spokesperson, brushed off the criticism and said the United States does not seek confrontation with Beijing. He said, "We seek a strategic competition with China. We do not seek conflict. We aim to compete and we aim to win that competition with China, but we absolutely want to keep it at that level." U.S. officials often speak of establishing guardrails in the bilateral relationship to prevent tensions from escalating into crises. Relations between Washington and Beijing deteriorated sharply after former U.S. President Donald Trump launched a trade war against China in 2018. China hoped for an improvement in relations under the administration of Joe Biden, but this never happened. The U.S. continued its hardline policies toward China under the Biden administration. China has repeatedly rebuked the U.S. for its growing nexus with Taiwan, as it regards the self-ruled island as its sovereign territory. The South China Sea, as well as the Ukraine war, are other sources of friction between Beijing and Washington. Bilateral relations soured further last month after a suspected Chinese spy balloon floated in American skies and was shot down by U.S. fighter jets. Beijing is critical of Washington's handling of the issue. According to some senior Republicans and U.S. military leaders, there is a growing concern that a full-scale conflict between the two superpowers is imminent, with the Asia-Pacific and South Asia regions likely to be the primary theaters of the conflict. That's because, besides boosting ties with Taiwan, the U.S. has also significantly increased its military activity in the South China Sea and other waters near Taiwan and China, causing Beijing to do the same, turning the region into a potential flashpoint for war.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. History has always been attractive to me. Before visiting any site, I try to find documents which tell me about the history of that place, which I find it very interesting. By the way, I am now in a public library in the city of Ardabil. I have come here to study about the bridges left from the Safavid era. You know, Ardabil is famous for its plentitude of rivers which are full of water. This city, which was once the capital of the Safavids, has many bridges which are all a kind of architectural masterpieces. So, after I finished my studies, I'll take a tour around the city in order to visit the first bridge, which is called Haft Cheshme Bridge.
Haft Cheshme Bridge, literally Seven Springs Bridge, is a limestone and stucco structure located in the city of Ardabil, northwestern Iran. Haft Cheshme Historical Bridge was built on Baleghluchay River during the Safavid era. This bridge, which has seven arches, is unique in architecture. In addition, it is exemplary in beauty. The materials used in the body of bridge and the deep bases are plaster, lime, and bricks in the exterior facing. The foundation also was constructed so strong and firm. The structure and the firmness of the bridge make it to be a healthy building without any signs of exhaustion. Haft Cheshme Bridge is registered in the list of National Heritage.
Well, we are just a few blocks away. Listen, it's the sound of Baleghluchay River. In local language, this name means the river which has many fish. Haft Cheshme Bridge is built on this river. On one side of this river, there is a village. We are near. I'll tell you something. The importance of such kind of bridges is not just for its great architecture. Rather, they are important structures historically. As you might know, many of the bridges built in this city were constructed during the Safavid era, which was the era of perfection and flourishing of the ingenuity of architecture and urbanism in Iran. Oh, look! Here it is, the Haft Cheshme Bridge.